it. Though he professed to see no religious aspect to recent events, in his heart of hearts, the priest had retained hope that the miraculous cures and apparitional lights were of divine origin. He had been depressed by the dismayingly secular thought that the gift could have been bestowed on him not by his Lord, but simply as the chance side effect of an exotic infection, by the unwitting office of a mindless virus, and a man-made virus as well. He was relieved to be able to dismiss that possibility. His high spirits and good humor, even amidst the destruction of the diner, arose from the fact that a divine presence was once again, for Brendan, at least a viable, if still unlikely, explanation. Dom wished he too could find courage and strength in the notion that their troubles were part of a divine scheme. But at the moment, he believed only in danger and death, twin juggernauts that he sensed bearing down on him. The personality changes that had occurred in him during his move from Portland to Mountain View were laughably minor in comparison to the changes that had begun working in him tonight with the discovery of this unwanted power. He almost felt as if the power was alive in him, a parasite that in time would eat away everything that had been Dominic Corvaces, and having assumed his identity, would stalk the world in his body, masquerading as human. Crazy. Nevertheless, he was worried and scared. He looked at each of the others who were gathered around him. Some met his eyes for a moment, then quickly looked away, just as one might hesitate to meet the gaze of a dangerous or intimidating man. Others, most notably Jack Twist, Ernie, and Georgia, met his eyes forthrightly, but were incapable of concealing the uneasiness and even apprehension with which they now regarded him. Only Ginger and Brendan seemed to have suffered no change in their attitude toward him.
"Well," Jack said, breaking the spell, "we should call it a night, I guess. We've got a lot to do tomorrow."
"Tomorrow," Ginger said, "we'll have cleared up even more of these mysteries. We're making progress every day."
"Tomorrow," Brendan said softly, happily, "will be a day of great revelation. I feel it somehow."
Tomorrow, Dom thought, we might all be dead. Or wish we were. Colonel Leland Falkirk still had a splitting headache. With his new talent for introspection, acquired gradually since his involvement in the emotionally and intellectually shattering events of 2 summers ago, he was able to see that, on one level, he was actually glad that the aspirin had been ineffective. He thrived on the headache in the same way he thrived on other kinds of pain, drawing a perverse strength and energy from the relentless throbbing in his brow and temples. Lieutenant Horner had gone. Leland was alone once more in his temporary, windowless office beneath the testing grounds of Schenckfield, but he was no longer waiting for the call from Chicago. It had come soon after Horner departed, and the news had been all bad. The siege at Galvin Sharkle's house in Evanston, which had begun earlier today, was still underway, and that volatile situation would probably not be brought to an end within the next 12 hours. If possible, the colonel did not want to commit his men to another closure of I-80 and another quarantine of the Tranquility Motel until he could be certain the operation would not be compromised by revelations that Sharkle might make either to Illinois authorities or to the news media. Delay made Leland nervous, especially now that the witnesses at the motel were focused on Thunder Hill and were planning their moves beyond the reach of rifle microphones and infinity transmitters. He figured he could afford to wait at most one more day. However, if the dangerous standoff in Illinois was still underway by sunset tomorrow, he would give the order to move on the Tranquility in spite of the risks. The other news from Chicago was that operatives had discreetly investigated Emmeline Hallberg and Winton Toke and had found reasons to believe their amazing recoveries could not be adequately explained by current medical knowledge. And a reconstruction of Father Stefan Vikazic's activities on Christmas Day, including visits to Hallberg and Toke and a stop at the Metropolitan Police Laboratory to consult a ballistics expert, confirmed that the priest had been convinced that his curate, Brendan Cronin had been responsible for those miraculous cures. Leland had first become aware of Cronin's healing powers just yesterday, Sunday, when he had monitored a telephone call between Dominic Corvasis at the Tranquility and Father Vikazic in Chicago. That conversation would have been a real shocker if the events of Saturday night had not prepared him for the unexpected. Saturday night, when Corvasis had arrived at the Tranquility, Leland Falkirk and his surveillance experts had monitored the first conversations between the blocks and the writer with growing disbelief. The outlandish tale of moon photographs animated by a poltergeist in Lomax's Reno house had sounded like the product of a fevered mind no longer able to distinguish between fiction and reality. Later, however, after Corvasis and the blocks had eaten dinner at the grill, the writer had attempted to relive the minutes just before the trouble had started on the night of July 6th. What happened then was astonishing, confirmed both by the hidden surveillance team watching the Tranquility from a point south of the interstate and by the infinity transmitter tap on the diner's payphone. Everything in the grill had begun to shake, and a strange rumble had filled the place, then an eerie electronic ululation culminating in the implosion of all the windows. These phenomena came as a total and nasty surprise to Leland and to everyone involved in the cover-up, especially the scientists, who were electrified. The following day's discovery of Cronin's healing power added voltage to the excitement. At first, these developments seemed inexplicable, but after only a little thought, Leland arrived at an explanation that made his blood cold. The scientists had come to similar conclusions. Some of them were as scared as Leland was. Suddenly no one knew what to expect. Anything might happen now. "We believe we were in control of the situation that night in July," Leland thought somberly, "but perhaps it had escalated beyond our control even before we arrived on the scene." The single consolation was that, thus far, only Corvasis and the priest appeared to be infected. Maybe infected wasn't exactly the right word. Maybe possessed was better. Or maybe there wasn't a word for what had happened to them, because what had happened to them had never happened to anyone else in history, so a specific word for it had not heretofore been required. Even if the siege at Sharkle's house ended tomorrow, even if that possibility of media exposure was eliminated, Leland would not be able to strike at the group at the motel with full confidence. Corvasis and Cronin, and perhaps the others, might be more difficult to apprehend and incarcerate than they'd been 2 summers ago. If Corvasis and Cronin weren't entirely themselves anymore, if they were now someone else, or something else, dealing with them might prove downright impossible. Leland's headache was worse.
"Feed on it,"
he told himself, getting up from the desk.
"Feed on the pain. You've been doing that for years, you dumb son of a bitch. So you can feed on it for another day or two, until you've dealt with this mess, or until you're dead, whichever comes first."
He left the windowless office, crossed the windowless outer chamber, walked the windowless hall, and entered the windowless communications center, where Lieutenant Horner and Sergeant Fix sat at a table in one corner.
"Tell the man that can hit the sack," Leland said. "It's off for tonight. I'll risk another day to see if the situation at Sharkle's house gets resolved."
"I was just coming to you," Horner said. "There's a development at the motel. They finally left the diner. After they came out, Twist brought a Jeep Cherokee in from the hills behind the motel. He, Georgia Monotella, and the priest piled in it and drove off toward Elko."
"Where the hell are they going at this time of night?" Leland asked,
uncomfortably aware that those three might have slipped through his fingers if he had ordered his men to move against the motel tonight, for he'd been certain the witnesses were settled down until morning. Horner pointed to Fix, who was wearing headphones and listening to the Tranquility.
"From what we've heard, the others have gone to bed. Twist, Monotella, and Cronin have gone off as sort of insurance against us getting our hands on all the witnesses in one quick, clean sweep. This had to be Twist's idea."
"Damn."
Massaging his throbbing temples with his fingertips, Leland sighed.
"All right.
We aren't going after them tonight anyway.
But what about tomorrow? What if they split up all day tomorrow?
In the morning, Leland said, we'll put tails on all of them.
To this point he had seen no need to tail the witnesses everywhere they went, for he had known that, in the end, they would all wind up at the same place, the motel, making it easier for him to deal with them. But now, if they were going to be spread out when the time came to take them into custody, he would need to know where they were at all times. Horner said,
depending on where they go tomorrow, they're likely to spot any tails we put on them. In this kind of open country, it's not easy to be discreet.
I know, Leland said. So let them see us. I've wanted to stay out of sight, but we're at the end of that approach. Maybe seeing us will throw them off balance until it's too late. Maybe scared, they'll even get back together for protection and make our job easier again.
If we have to take some of them at a place other than the motel, say an Elko, it'll be difficult, Horner said worriedly.
If they can't be taken, they've got to be killed.
Leland pulled up a chair, sat down.
Let's work out surveillance details now and have the tails in position before dawn.
3. Tuesday, January 14th. At 7:30 Tuesday morning, in response to a telephone call from Brendan Cronin very late the previous night, Father Stefan Vikazic prepared to set out on a drive to Evanston, to the last known address of Calvin Sharkle, the trucker who had been at the Tranquility Motel that summer but whose telephone was now disconnected. In light of the enormity of last evening's developments in Nevada, everyone was agreed that every possible effort must be made to contact the other victims who had thus far been unreachable. Standing in the warm rectory kitchen, Stefan buttoned his topcoat and put on his fedora. Father Michael Girano, who was just sitting down to oatmeal and toast after celebrating sunrise mass, said,
"Perhaps I should know more about this whole situation, about what on earth's wrong with Brendan in case, well, in case something happens to you?"
"Nothing's going to happen to me," Father Vikazic said firmly. "God hasn't let me spend 5 decades learning how the world works just to have me killed now that I'm able to do my best work for the church."
Michael shook his head.
"You're always so..."
"Certain in my faith? Of course I am. Rely on God and he will never fail you, Michael."
"Actually,"
Michael said, smiling,
"I was going to say you're always so bullheaded."
"Such impudence from a curate,"
Stefan said, winding a thick white scarf around his neck.
"Attendee, Father. What is wanted of a curate is humility, self-effacement, the strong back of a mule, the stamina of a plow horse, and an unfailingly adoring attitude toward his rector."
Michael grinned.
"Oh, yes. I suppose if the rector is a pious old geezer grown vain from the praise of his parishioners..."
The telephone rang.
"If it's for me, I'm gone," Stefan said.
Stefan pulled on a pair of gloves, but was not quite able to make it to the back door before Michael held the receiver toward him.
"It's Winton Toke," Michael said. "The cop whose life Brendan saved? He sounds almost hysterical, and he wants to talk to Brendan."
Stefan took the phone and identified himself. The policeman's voice was haunted and full of urgency.
"Father, I've got to talk to Brendan Cronin right away. He can't wait." "I'm afraid he's away," Stefan said, "out at the other end of the country. What's the matter? Can I be of assistance?"
"Cronin," Toke said shakily. Something's happened, and I don't understand. It's strange. Jesus, it's the strangest, craziest thing. But I knew right away it was somehow related to Brendan."
"I'm sure I can help. Where are you, Winton?"
"On duty. End of the shift, graveyard shift, uptown. There's been a knifing. A shooting. Horrible. And then...
Listen, I want Cronin to come up here. He's got to explain this. He's got to. Right away."
Father Vikazic elicited an address from Tolk, left the rectory at a run, and drove too fast. Less than half an hour later, he arrived in a block of identical, shabby, 6-story brick tenements in the uptown district. He was unable to park in front of the address he had been given and settled for a spot near the corner, for the prime space was occupied by police vehicles, marked and unmarked cars, an SID wagon, whose radios filled the cold air with a metallic chorus of dispatcher's codes and jargon. Two officers were watching over the vehicles to prevent vandalism. In answer to Stefan's question, they told him the action was on the third floor, in 3B, the Mendoza's apartment. The glass in the front door was cracked across one corner, and the temporary repair with electrician's tape looked as if it had become a permanent solution. The door opened on a grim foyer. Some floor tiles were missing and others were hidden by grime. The paint was peeling. As he climbed the stairs, Stefan encountered two beautiful children playing dead doll with a battered Raggedy Ann and an old shoebox. When he walked through the open door and into the Mendoza's third-floor apartment, Father Vikazic saw a beige sofa liberally stained with still-wet blood, so much that in some places the cushions were almost black. Hundreds of drops had sprayed across the pale yellow wall behind the sofa, a pattern that evidently had resulted when someone in front of the wall had been hit by large-caliber slugs that passed through him. Four bullet holes marred the plaster. Blood was spattered over a lampshade, coffee table, bookshelf, and part of the carpet. The gore was even more disgusting than it might ordinarily have been, because the apartment was otherwise extremely well kept, which made the areas of bloody chaos more shocking by comparison. The Mendozas could afford to live only in a slum tenement, but like some other poor people, they refused to surrender to, or become part of, the uptown squalor. The filth of the streets, the grime of public hallways and staircases, stopped at their door, as if their apartment was a fortress against dirt, a shrine to cleanliness and order. Everything gleamed. Removing his fedora, Stefan took only two steps into the living room, which flowed without interruption into a small dining area, which itself was separated from a half-sized kitchen by a serving counter. The place was crowded with detectives, uniformed officers, lab technicians, maybe a dozen men altogether. Most of them were not acting like cops. Their demeanor puzzled Stefan. Apparently, the lab men had completed their work and the others had nothing to do, yet no one was leaving. They were standing in groups of two or three, talking in the subdued manner of people at a funeral parlor or in church. Only one detective was working. He was sitting at the dinette table with a Madonna-faced Latino woman of about 40, asking questions of her. Father Vikazic heard him call her Mrs. Mendoza, and recording her answers on legal-looking forms. She was trying to cooperate, but was distracted as she glanced repeatedly at a man her own age, probably her husband, who was pacing back and forth with a child in his arms. The child was a cute boy of about 6. Mr. Mendoza held the child in one burly arm, talking constantly to him, patting him, ruffling his thick hair. Obviously, this man had almost lost his son in whatever violence had occurred here, and he needed to touch and hold the child to convince himself that the worst had not actually happened. One of the patrolmen noticed Stefan and said, "Father Vikazic?" The officer's voice was soft, but at the mention of Stefan's name, the entire group fell silent. Stefan could not remember ever seeing expressions quite like those that came over the faces of the people in the Mendoza's small apartment, as if he were expected to deliver onto them a single sentence that would shed light upon all the mysteries of existence and succinctly convey the meaning of life. "What in the world is going on here?" Stefan wondered uneasily. "This way, Father," said a uniformed officer. Pulling off his gloves, Stefan followed the officer across the room. The hush prevailed, and everyone made way for the priest and his guide. They went into a pin-neat bedroom, where Winton Toke and another officer were sitting on the edge of the bed. "Father Vikazic's here," Stefan's guide said, then retreated to the living room. Toke was sitting bent forward, his elbows on his knees, his face hidden in his hands. He did not look up. The other officer rose from the edge of the bed and introduced himself as Paul Armis, Winton's partner. I think you'd better get it directly from Win," Armis said.
I'll give you some privacy.
He left, closing the door behind him. The bedroom was small, with space for only the bed, one nightstand, a half-sized dresser, one chair. Father Vikazic pulled the chair around to face the foot of the bed and sat down so he could look directly at Winton Tolk. Their knees were almost touching. Removing his scarf, Father Vikazic said, "Winton, what's happened?" Tolk looked up, and Stefan was startled by the man's expression. He had thought Tolk was upset by whatever had happened in the living room, but his face revealed that he was exhilarated, filled with an excitement he could barely contain. Simultaneously, he seemed fearful, not terrified, not quaking with fear, but troubled by something that prevented him from giving in completely, happily, to his excitement.
"Father, who is Brendan Cronin?"
The tremor in the big man's voice was of an odd character that might have betrayed either incipient joy or terror.
"What is Brendan Cronin?"
Stefan hesitated, decided on the full truth.
"He's a priest."
Winton shook his head.
"But that's not what we were told."
Stefan sighed, nodded. He explained about Brendan's loss of faith and about the unconventional therapy that had included a week in a police patrol car.
"You and Officer Armis weren't told he was a priest because you might have treated him differently, and because I wished to spare him embarrassment."
"A fallen priest,"
Winton said, looking baffled.
"Not fallen," Father Vikazic said confidently. "Merely faltering. He'll regain his faith in time."
The room's inadequate light came from a dim lamp on the nightstand, and from a single, narrow window, leaving the dark policeman in velvet gloom. The whites of his eyes were twin lamps, very bright by contrast with the darknesses of shadows and genetic heritage.
"How did Brendan heal me when I was shot? How did he perform that miracle? How?"
"Why have you decided it was a miracle?"
"I was shot twice in the chest, point blank. 3 days later, I left the hospital. 3 days. In 10 days, I was ready to go back to work, but they made me stay home 2 weeks. Doctors kept talking about my hardy physical condition, the extraordinary healing that's possible if a body's in tip-top shape. I started thinking they were trying to explain my recovery not to me but to themselves. But I still figured I was just really lucky. I came back to work a week ago, and then something else happened."
Winton unbuttoned his shirt, pulled it open, and lifted his undershirt to reveal his bare chest.
"The scars."
Father Vikazic shivered. Though he was close to Winton, he leaned closer, staring in amazement. The man's chest was unmarked. Well, not entirely unmarked, but the entry wounds had already healed until they were just discolored spots as big as dimes. The surgeon's incisions had almost vanished, thin lines visible now only on close inspection. This soon, after major trauma, some swelling and inflammation should have been evident, but there was none. The minimal scar tissue was pale pink-brown against dark brown skin, neither lumpy nor puckered.
"I've seen other guys with old bullet wounds," Winton said, his excitement still restrained by a rope of fear. "Lots of them. Gnarly. Thick. Ugly. You don't take 238s in the chest, undergo major surgery, and look like this 3 weeks later. Or ever. When's the last time you visited your doctor? Has he seen this?"
Winton rebuttoned his shirt with trembling hands.
"I saw Dr. Sonnefort a week ago. The sutures hadn't been removed long before, and my chest was still a mess. It's only been the past 4 days that the scars melted away. I swear, Father, if I stand at a mirror long enough, I can see them fading."
Finishing with his shirt buttons, Winton said,
"Lately, I've been thinking about your visit to the hospital Christmas Day. The more I've gone over it in my mind, the more it seems your behavior was peculiar. I remember some of what you said, some of the questions you asked about Brendan, and I start wondering. One thing I wonder about.
One thing I got to know is whether Brendan Cronin ever healed anyone else.
Yes.
Nothing as dramatic as your case, but there's another. I'm not at liberty to reveal who, Stefan said. But this isn't why you called the rectory, Wynne. Not to show Brendan how well you've healed. Your voice was so full of urgency, even panic. And what about all these policemen with the Mendozas? What's happened here, Wynton?
A mercurial smile appeared on and quickly faded from the man's broad face, followed by a transient glimmer of fear. Emotional turmoil was also evident in his voice.
We're cruising, me and Paul. We get a call, this address. We get here, find a 16-year-old kid high on PCP. You know what they're like on PCP sometimes? Crazy. Animals. Damn stuff eats brain cells. Later, after it's over, we find out his name's Ernesto, son of Mrs. Mendoza's sister. He came to live here a week ago because his mother can't control him anymore. The Mendozas? They're good people. You see how they keep this place?
Father Vikazic nodded.
Wynton said, the kind of people take in a nephew when he's gone wrong. Try to set him straight. But you can't set a kid like that straight. You break your heart trying, Father. This Ernesto, he's been in trouble since he was in fifth grade. Juvenile arrest record, 6 offenses, 2 of them pretty serious. We get here. He's naked as a jaybird, screaming his head off, eyes bugged out like the pressure in his head's going to blow his skull apart.
Wynton's gaze unfocused, as if he were seeing back into time and had as clear a view of that scene as when he had first encountered it.
Ernesto's got Hector, the little boy you probably saw when you came in. He's got him down on the sofa, holding him, and he's got a goddamn 6-inch switchblade at Hector's throat. Mr. Mendoza, well, he's going crazy, wanting to rush Ernesto and take the knife, but scared Ernesto will slash Hector. Ernesto's screaming he was blissed on angel dust. He's PCP crazy, and you can't talk sense to him. We drew our guns because you don't just walk up to some doped-out freak with a knife and shake hands. But we didn't want to try to shoot him because he had the knife at Hector's throat. Hector was crying, and Ernesto could have killed the kid if we made the wrong move. So we tried to talk him down, talk him away from Hector. And we seemed to make headway, because he started to take the knife off the boy. But then, all of a sudden, Jesus, he slashed, quick, cut Hector's throat almost from ear to ear, deep.
Wynton shuddered.
Deep. Then he raised the knife over his head, so we shot him. I'm not sure how many times. Blew him away. And he fell dead on top of Hector. We pulled him off, and there was little Hector, one hand, trying to close up the hole in his throat. Blood spurting between his fingers, eyes already glazing over.
The cop took a deep breath and shuddered again. His eyes came back into focus as if he needed to retreat from the horror of the past. He looked toward the window, beyond which the gray winter daylight sifted like soot over the gray uptown street. Stefan's heart had begun to pound, not because of the bloody horror that Wynton had described, but because he could see where the cop's story had to be leading, and he was eager to hear the miracle described. Looking at the window, Wynton continued. His voice grew shakier as he spoke.
There's no first aid for that kind of wound, Father. Severed arteries, veins, big arteries in the neck. Blood pumps out like water from a hose, and you can't use a tourniquet, not on the neck. And direct pressure won't seal up a carotid artery, shit no. I knelt on the floor beside the sofa, and I saw Hector was dying fast. He looked so little. Father, so little. That kind of wound, they're gone in 2 minutes. Sometimes a lot less.
He was so little. I knew it was useless. But I put my hands on Hector's neck, like somehow I could hold the blood in him, hold the life in him. I was sick, angry, scared, and it just wasn't right that a boy so little should die that way, that hard. Not right he should die at all, not right. And then he healed, Father Bekazik said softly.
Wenton Tok finally looked away from the gray light at the window and met Stefan's eyes.
Yes, Father. He healed. He was soaked in his own blood, seconds away from death, but he healed. I didn't even know what was happening. Didn't feel it happening. Nothing special in my hands. Wouldn't you think I'd feel something special in my hands? But the first I realized that something incredible was happening was when the blood stopped spurting against my fingers, and the boy shut his eyes at the same time, which was when I thought he was dead for sure, and I shouted, "No! God, no!" And I started to take my hands away from Hector's throat to look at it, and that's when I saw the wound was closed up. It still had a raw, ugly look to it, an awful line with a knife cut deep, but the flesh was knit together into a bright red scar, a healing scar. The big man stopped speaking because shimmery lenses of tears had formed over his eyes. He was overcome once more. If he'd been racked by grief, he probably would have suppressed it. But this was something even more powerful. Joy. Pure. Wild, disbelieving joy. He could not contain several explosive, wrenching sobs. With hot tears in his own eyes, Father Bekazik held out both hands. Wenton took them, squeezed them tight, and did not let go as he continued. "Paul, my partner, saw it happen. So did the Mendozas, and two other uniforms arrived just as we shot Ernesto. They saw it, too. And when I looked at that red line across his throat, somehow I knew what I had to do. I put my hands on the boy again, covered up the wound again, and I thought about him being alive. Sort of wished him alive. My mind was in high gear, and I made the connection with Brendan and me, the sandwich shop. I thought about how the scars on my chest had been disappearing the last few days, and I knew somehow it's connected, so I kept my hands on his throat. And in a minute or so, he opened his eyes. He smiled at me. You should have seen that smile, Father. So I took my hands away again. And the scar was there, but lighter. The boy sat up and asked for his mother. And that's when I went to pieces.
Wenton paused and gulped some air.
Mrs. Mendoza took Hector into the bathroom, stripped him out of his bloody clothes, bathed him, and all the time more people from the department kept showing up. Word was getting around. Thank God the reporters haven't cottoned to it yet.
For a while, the two men sat facing each other in silence, gripping hands. Then Stefan said,
"Did you try to bring Ernesto back?"
"Yes. In spite of what he'd done, I put my hands on his wounds. But it didn't work with him, Father. Maybe because he was already dead. Hector was only dying. Not yet gone, but Ernesto was dead."
"Did you notice odd marks in your hands, on your palms? Red rings of swollen flesh?" Nothing like that. What would it have meant if there had been rings?
I don't know, Father Bekazik said. But they appear in Brendan's hands when these things happen. They were silent again, and then went and said,
Is Brendan? Is Father Cronin some kind of saint?
Father Bekazik smiled.
He's a good man, but he's no saint. Then how did he heal me?
I don't know, precisely. But surely it's a manifestation of the power of God, somehow, for some reason.
But how did Brendan pass along his power to heal?
I don't know, Winton. If he did pass it along, maybe the power isn't yours. Maybe it's just God acting through you. First through Brendan and then through you. At last, Winton let go of Father Vikazik's hands. He turned his palms up and stared at them.
No. The power's still here. Still in me, I know that. Somehow I feel it, and not just the power to heal. There's more.
Father Bekazik raised his eyebrows.
More? What else?
Winton frowned.
I don't know yet. It's all so new, so strange. But I feel more. It'll take time for it to develop.
He looked up from the pale palms of his calloused black hands, awe-stricken and fearful.
What is Father Cronin? And what has he made of me?
Winton, get rid of the notion there's anything evil or dangerous about this. It's entirely a wondrous thing. Think of Hector, the child you saved. Remember what it was like to feel life regaining its hold in his small body. We're players in a divine mystery, Winton. We can't understand the meaning of it until God allows us to understand. Father Bekazik said he wanted to have a look at the boy, Hector Mendoza, and went and said,
I'm not ready to go out there and face that crowd. Even though they're mostly my people, I'll stay here a while. You'll come back?
I got other rather urgent business this morning, Winton. I have to get on with it soon. But I'll be in touch with you.
Oh, you can be sure of that. And if you need me, just call St. Betts.
When Stefan left the bedroom, the waiting crowd of policemen and lab technicians fell silent as before. They parted in his path as he crossed to the dinette table, where little Hector was now perched on his mother's lap, nibbling happily at a Hershey bar with almonds. The boy was small, even for a six-year-old, with delicate facial bones. His eyes were bright and full of intelligence, proof that he'd suffered no brain damage in spite of losing most of his blood. But even more astonishing was the fact that his lost blood had evidently been replaced without need of transfusions, which made the boy's recovery even more miraculous than Toke's. The power in Winton's hands seemed greater than it had been in Brendan's. When Father Bekazik stooped down to be at eye level with Hector, the child grinned at him.
How are you feeling, Hector?
Okay,
the boy said shyly.
Do you remember what happened to you, Hector?
The child licked chocolate from his lips and shook his head. No.
Is that a good candy bar?
The boy nodded and offered Father Bekazik a bite. The priest smiled.
Thank you, Hector. But that's all yours.
Mama might give you one, Hector said. But don't drop any on the carpet. That's big trouble.
Stefan looked up at Mrs. Mendoza.
He really doesn't remember?
No. God lifted the memory from him, Father.
You're Catholic, Mrs. Mendoza?
Yes, Father,
she said, crossing herself with her free hand.
Do you attend Our Lady of Sorrow?
Yes, well, that's Father Nilo's parish. Have you called him?
No, Father. I didn't know if...
Father Bekazik looked up at Mr. Mendoza, who stood on the other side of his wife's chair. Call Father Nilo. Tell him what's happened. Ask him to come.
Explain that I'll be gone when he gets here, but that I'll talk to him later. Explain that I've much to tell him, that what he sees here isn't the whole story. Mr. Mendoza hurried to the telephone. Looking up at one of the detectives who had come close, Stefan said, "Have you taken pictures of the boy's throat wound?" The detective nodded.
"Yeah, standard procedure."
He laughed nervously.
"What am I saying? There's nothing standard about this."
"Just so you have photographs to prove this happened," Father Vikazic said. "Because I think soon there will be little or no scar." He turned to the boy again. "Now, Hector, if it's okay, I'd like to touch your throat. I'd like to feel that mark." The boy lowered the candy bar. Father Vikazic's fingers were trembling when they touched the fiery scar tissue and moved slowly around the boy's neck from one end of the wound to the other. A strong pulse beat in the carotid arteries on each side of the slender young throat, and Stefan's heart leapt when he felt the miracle of life. Death had been defeated here, and Stefan believed he had been privileged to witness a fulfillment of the promise which was at the root of the Church's existence. "Death shall not last. Unto you shall be given life everlasting." Tears rose in the priest's eyes. When at last Stefan reluctantly took his hand away from the boy and stood, one of the policemen said,
"What's it mean, Father? I heard you tell Mr. Mendoza this wasn't the whole story. What's happening?"
Stefan turned to look upon the assembly, which now numbered 20. In their faces he saw a longing to believe, not particularly in the truths of Catholicism or Christianity, for not all were Catholics or Christians, but a deep-seated longing to believe in something greater and better and cleaner than humankind, an intense yearning for spiritual transcendence.
"What's it mean, Father?"
one of them asked again.
"Something's happening," he told them.
"Here, elsewhere.
A great and wonderful something. This child is part of it. I can't tell you for sure what it means, or that we've seen the hand of God here, though I believe we have. Look at Hector on his mother's lap, eating candy, and remember God's promise. There shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. In my heart of hearts, I feel that the former things are about to pass away. Now I must go. I've urgent business." Somewhat to his surprise, even though his explanation had been vague, they parted to make way for him and did not detain him further, perhaps because the miracle of Hector Mendoza had not been vague, had in fact been emphatically specific, and had already given them more answers than they could handle. But as Stefan went, some reached out to touch him, to squeeze his hand or shoulder, not with religious fervor, but with an emotional camaraderie. Stefan was overcome by the need to touch them as well, to share a profound sense of the community of humankind, which had filled everyone in the room, to share the conviction that they were being swept towards some great destiny.
In Boston, at 10 o'clock, Alexander Christopherson, former United States Senator and ambassador to Great Britain, former director of the CIA, now retired for a decade, was reading the morning newspaper when he received a telephone call from his brother Philip, the antiques dealer in Greenwich, Connecticut. They spoke for 5 minutes about nothing important, just two brothers keeping in touch, but the conversation had a secret purpose. At the end, Philip said,
"Oh, by the way, I spoke with Diana just this morning. You remember her?" "I certainly do," Alex said. "How's she doing?" "Oh, she has her troubles," Philip said. "Too boring to discuss. But she says hello."
Then he changed the subject, recommending two new books that Alex might enjoy, as if Diana were of no real importance. Diana was the code word that meant Ginger Weiss had phoned Philip and needed to speak with Alex. The moment he had seen Ginger at Pablo's funeral, her silver blonde hair a shimmer as if with a light of its own, she had made him think of Diana, the goddess of the moon. After he said goodbye to Philip, he told his wife, Elena, that he intended to drive to the mall.
I want to stop at the bookstore and pick up a couple of novels that Philip recommended. He actually went to the mall, but before he bought the books, he found a public phone booth and, using his AT&T credit card, called Philip to get the number that Ginger Weiss had left.
She says it's a payphone in Elko, Nevada, Philip told him.
When Alex put the Nevada call through, Ginger Weiss did not answer until the fifth ring.
Sorry, she said. I was in the car parked beside the booth. It was just too cold to stand here and wait.
What are you doing in Nevada?
Alex asked.
If I understood you correctly at Pablo's funeral, you really don't want me to answer questions like that.
Right. Less I know, the better. What did you want to ask me?
She explained, with a minimum of detail, that she had found others suffering from memory blocks similar to hers, some with different false memories covering the same time span. Since Alex was the expert on brainwashing, Ginger wanted to know if implanting fake memories that included threads of reality was more difficult than implanting entirely false recollections, and he was able to assure her that indeed it was.
That's what we figured, Ginger said. But it's good to hear you confirm it. Shows we're on the right track. Now, one more thing. I want you to get some information for us. We need to know whatever you can learn about a Colonel Leland Falkirk, an officer in one of the Army's elite Dero companies. I also need...
Wait, Alex said, looking nervously through the glass door of the booth at shoppers walking past in the mall, as if he were already under observation or even targeted for removal.
At the cemetery, I said I'd provide advice or background on mind control techniques, but I warned you I wouldn't dig up information. I explained my position.
Well, even though you've been retired for years, you must still know people in many of the right places.
Didn't you hear me, Doctor? I will not get actively involved in your problems. I simply can't afford to. I've got too much to lose.
Now, don't worry about digging up anything exotic or highly classified. We don't expect that,
she said, as if she had not heard him.
Just the bare details of Falkirk's service record might help us understand him and form an idea of what to expect from him.
Please!
But she was indefatigable. I also need to know about the Thunderhill Depository, an army facility here in Elko County.
No.
It's supposed to be an underground storage facility, and maybe that's all it was for a long time, or maybe it's always been something else, but I know it's not just an underground warehouse these days.
Doctor, I won't do this for you.
Colonel Leland Falkirk and Thunderhill Depository. It's not so much to ask. No deep snooping, just what details you can glean. Talk to your old friends who are still in the game. Then report to either Dr. George Hannaby there in Boston or to Father Stefan Vikazic, a priest in Chicago.
She gave him phone numbers.
I can get in touch with them, and they won't mention your name when they tell me what you've reported. That way, you don't have to call me direct and you stay in the clear.
He tried and failed to control the palsied shaking of his hands.
Doctor, I'm sorry I volunteered even limited assistance. I'm an old man who's afraid to die.
You're also worried about sins you might have committed in the name of duty, she said, repeating what he had told her at the cemetery. And you'd probably like to do something to atone for some of those sins, real or imagined. This would be atonement of a sort, Mr. Christofferson.
She repeated the telephone numbers for Hannaby and Vikazic.
No. If you are interrogated, remember I said no, emphatically no.
With maddening good cheer, she said, Oh, and it would help if you had something for me within the next 6 or 8 hours. I know that's a tall order, but then again, I'm only asking for basic information, whatever's in the unclassified files.
Goodbye, Doctor, he said pointedly.
I'll look forward to hearing from you.
You will not hear from me.
Toodaloo,
she said, and hung up on him first.
Christ,
he said, slamming the receiver down. She was an attractive woman, personable, intelligent, appealing in so many ways. But her absolute conviction that she would always get what she wanted. This was a trait he sometimes admired in a man,
seldom or never in a woman. Well, she'd be disappointed this time. This time she'd not get what she wanted. Damned if she would. Yet, with his cross pen, he had made note of the telephone numbers for Hanabi and Vikazik, which she had given him. Dom and Ernie set out early Tuesday morning to reconnoiter at least part of the perimeter of Thunderhill Depository. They went in Jack Twist's new Jeep Cherokee. Jack himself was sleeping back at the motel, having gone to bed only a few hours ago, after spending half the night driving around Elko, staying on the move with Brendan Cronin and Georgia Monatella. Both the Cherokee and the motel's Dodge van had four-wheel drive, but the Jeep was tougher, more maneuverable. The foothill and mountain roads up toward Thunderhill might be icy in spots, and as the day promised new snow, they wanted the most reliable transportation. Dom did not like the look of the sky. Thick, dark clouds hung low over the high plains, lower over the foothills, and obscured the tops of the mountains. The weather forecast called for the first big storm of the year, later than usual this season, as much as 14 inches of snow in the higher elevations. Not a single flake had fallen yet. The raised and threatening lash of winter did not induce a pensive mood in Dom or Ernie. They were in high spirits upon setting out from the motel. They were finally doing something. Acting, not just reacting. In addition, there was the pleasant fellowship that exists when men who like each other set out on an adventure together. A fishing trip, or an expedition to a ballpark, or a scouting trip to explore the perimeter defenses of a military installation. In no little measure, their excellent mood grew from the unexpected peacefulness of the night just past. For the first time in weeks, Dom's sleep hadn't been disturbed by nightmares or sleepwalking. He had dreamed only of an undetailed chamber filled with golden light, evidently the same place that featured in Brendan's dreams. Likewise, instead of lying awake in fear of the shadows beyond the glow of the bedside lamp, Ernie had drifted off to sleep at once. The others also said it was the most restful night in recent memory. Ginger's theory, put forth over a quick cup of coffee this morning, was that their worst dreams had been related not to the mysterious events they had witnessed on the night of July 6th, but to the subsequent brainwashing. Therefore, now that they had an idea of what they'd endured at the hands of the mind-control experts, the subconscious pressure related to those experiences was relieved, eliminating the source of those particular bad dreams. And Dom had a reason of his own to feel good about the day. This morning, no one had looked warily at him or treated him with deference because of his telekinetic power. At first he was baffled by their quick adjustment to his new status. Then he realized what must be going through their minds. Since they had shared his experiences of the summer before last, it was logical that they would also share his strange power, sooner or later. They must believe their own development of paranormal abilities was merely lagging behind his. Eventually, if they did not acquire the power, they might build the emotional, intellectual, and psychological walls between them and him that would isolate him, as he feared. But for the moment, anyway, they were acting as if no gulf separated them from him, and he was grateful. Now, humming softly, Ernie drove north on the two-lane county road, leaving the motel and the interstate behind them. They climbed some of the same rugged hills down which Jack Twist had come last night when making his clandestine approach to the Tranquility, although Jack had traveled overland, and Dom studied the changing terrain with interest. The rising land seemed leaner the higher it rose, revealing less flesh and more rocky bones that poked up everywhere in clavicles and scapulae and sternums of limestone, in fibulae and femurs of crumbling shale, in occasional ribs and spines of formidable granite. As if in awareness of the colder air of higher altitudes, the land wore more clothes, thicker petticoats of grass, more lavish skirts of sage and other bushes, then trees. Trees, more trees, mountain mahogany, tall pines, cedar, quaking aspen, and on eastern slopes an occasional spruce or fir. They had gone only 3 miles when they reached the snow line.
A thin mantle flanked the road at first, but in the next 2 miles it deepened to 8 inches. Although a winter drought had held sway from September until early December, and although no major storm had swept the area yet this season, a few light snows had put down a respectable ground cover, also frosting the bristled boughs of the evergreens. But for a few small, scattered patches of ice, the county road was cleared for easy travel.
"They always keep it clean as far as Thunder Hill, even in killing weather," Ernie explained. "But up beyond the depository, the road crews don't do as thorough a job."
In no time, they had gone 10 miles, always following the crest of the valley that fell away on the east, and always with rising mountains on the west. They passed several dirt and gravel lanes leading to isolated homes and ranches in the eastward-sloping lands to their right, and at the 10-mile point, they reached the guarded entrance road to Thunder Hill Depository, also on the right. Ernie slowed the Cherokee but did not turn into the entranceway.
"Haven't been this far up here in a long time. They've made changes since I saw the place last. Didn't used to look this formidable."
A sign announced the depository. Beside the sign, another paved road branched off the county lane, leading away between towering pines of such a dark green hue they seemed nearly black in the somber pre-storm light. 15 feet in from the turnoff, the lane was blocked by long metal spikes that speared up from the pavement, precisely angled to puncture the tires of any vehicle that tried to proceed farther, but also large enough to catch on the axle of a hurtling truck or car and instantly arrest its progress. 20 feet beyond the spikes, there was a massive steel gate, crowned with spears, painted red. A concrete block guardhouse, 20 feet by 10, stood inside the gate, and its black metal door looked capable of withstanding a bazooka barrage. Ernie pulled to the edge of the main road and slowed almost to a full stop as they eased past the entrance to Thunder Hill. He pointed to a yard-square post at the verge of the entrance lane, just this side of the wicket spikes.
"Looks like an intercom to the guardhouse. Not just a voice link, either. One of those systems like they have in drive-in banks, with a video monitor so they can see you in your car. The man in the guardhouse approves a visitor before the road spikes lower and the gate opens. Even then, I'll bet there are permanently in place machine guns to take you out if the guard decides he's been duped after he's already opened the gates."
From each end of the gate, an 8-foot-high chain-link fence with a barbed wire overhang disappeared into the trees, and Dom noted a white sign with red lettering that warned, "Danger, electrified." Although the perimeter fence led into the forest, no trees overhung it. From the small sections that he could see flanking the main gate, there appeared to be a 20-foot-wide no-man's land on each side. Dom's good mood faded. He had thought that the security along the perimeter of the facility would be minimal. After all, once you got onto the grounds, the actual entrance to Thunder Hill was through 8- or 10-foot-thick blast doors set in the hillside. That barrier was so impregnable that it seemed wasteful to install maximum security around the entire outer edge of the property. Yet that was what they had done, which meant the secret they were guarding was so important that they did not even trust nuclear-proof doors and subterranean limestone vaults to keep it safe.
"The spikes in the road are new," Ernie said, "and the gate they had a couple of years ago was pretty flimsy by comparison. The fence was always here, but it wasn't electrified before."
"We've no hope at all of getting a look inside."
Although no one had said as much, for fear of sounding foolish, they all hoped they might get as far as the blast doors of the facility, have a look around the newly expanded grounds that had been taken from ranchers Brust and Dirksen, and be fortunate enough to stumble across another piece of the puzzle they were committed to solve. Dom had never imagined they would actually get inside the underground rooms of Thunder Hill. That was an improbable scenario. But from the comfort of the Tranquility Motel, getting onto the grounds and snooping around had not seemed like an impossible dream. Until now. Dom wondered if his newly discovered telekinetic powers might be used to circumvent the depository's fortifications,
but he dismissed that thought as quickly as it occurred to him. Until he could control the gift, it was of little use. It scared him. He sensed that the power was sufficient to cause tremendous destruction and death if he lost control of it, and he would not take the chance again, except under very tightly controlled conditions.
"Well," Ernie said, "it was never our intention to try waltzing through the front gate. Let's have a look along some of the perimeter fence."
He touched his foot lightly on the accelerator. Looking in the rearview mirror, he said,
"Oh, and by the way, we're being followed."
Startled, Dom turned and looked through the rear window of the Cherokee. Less than 100 yards behind was a pickup truck, an all-terrain job, loftily perched on tires twice as wide and more than twice as high as ordinary tires. Spotlights, currently unlit, were mounted on the roof, and a snowplow, currently raised off the road, was fitted to the front. Although Dom was certain that private citizens living in the mountains might own similar trucks, this one had the look of a military vehicle. The windshield was tinted, the driver unrevealed. He said,
"You sure they're following us? When did they show up?"
Piloting the Cherokee up the county road, Ernie said,
"I noticed them about half a mile after we left the motel. When we slow down, they slow down too. When we speed up, so do they."
"You think there's going to be trouble?"
"There will be if they ask for it. They're probably only army pussies," Ernie said.
He grinned. Dom laughed. "Don't get me in a war just to prove leathernecks are tougher than GIs. I'll happily accept your word for it." The road became steeper. The somber, ashen sky grew lower. The dark trees drew closer on both sides. The pickup stayed behind them. Mrs. Hallberg, Emmy's mother, answered the door, letting a puff of warm air out of the house into the frigid Chicago morning. Father Vikazik said,
"Sorry to come unannounced like this, but the most extraordinary thing is happening, and I had to find out if Emmy..."
He stopped in mid-sentence when he realized that Mrs. Hallberg was in terrible distress. Her eyes were wide with shock, with fear, too. Before he could ask what was wrong, she said,
"My God, it's you, Father. From the hospital, I remember, but how did you know to come? We haven't called anyone yet. How'd you know to come? What's happened?"
Rather than answer, she took him by the arm, ushered him inside, slammed the door, and hurried him upstairs.
"This way, quickly."
Coming directly from the Mendoza's apartment uptown, he expected to find something odd at the Hallberg place, but not this state of crisis. When they reached the second-floor hallway, Mr. Hallberg was there with one of Emmy's older sisters. They were standing halfway down the hall at an open door, staring into a room at something that seemed equally to attract and repel them. In the room, something thumped, rattled, then thumped twice again, followed by a musical burst of girlish laughter. Mr. Hallberg turned, a ghastly expression on his face, and blinked in surprise at Stefan.
"Father, thank God you're here. We didn't know what to do. Didn't want to make complete fools of ourselves by calling for help, and then maybe nothing's happening when help gets here, you know? But now you come, so it's settled, and I'm relieved."
Stefan looked warily through the open doorway and saw the usual accoutrements of a bedroom occupied by a girl of 10 going on 11, the changeling age between childhood and adolescence. Half a dozen teddy bears, big posters of the current teenage idols, boys utterly unknown to Stefan. A wooden hat rack hung with a collection of exotic chapeaus, probably purchased from thrift shops, roller skates, a tape deck, a flute lying in an open case. Emmy's other sister, in a white sweater, tartan plaid skirt and knee socks, was standing a few feet inside the room, pale and half-paralyzed. Emmy was standing up in bed, pajama-clad, looking even healthier than on Christmas Day. She was hugging a pillow, grinning at the same astonishing performance, a poltergeist at play that riveted her sister and frightened the rest of her family. As Father Vikazik stepped into the room, Emmy laughed delightedly at the antics of two small teddy bears waltzing in midair.
Their movements were nearly as precise and formal as those of real dancers. But the bears were not the only inanimate objects infused with magical life. The roller skates were not standing still in a corner, but were moving about on separate courses. This one past the foot of the bed and then to the closet door, that one to the desk, this one to the window, moving fast, then slow. The hats jiggled on the rack. A Care Bear on a bookshelf bounced up and down. Stefan went to the foot of the bed, careful to avoid the roller skates, and looked up at Emmy, who still stood on the mattress.
Emmy?
The girl glanced down at him.
Pudge's friend. Hello, Father. Isn't it terrific? Isn't it wild?
Emmy, is this you? He asked, gesturing at the capering objects.
Me?
She said, genuinely surprised.
No, not me.
But he noticed that the flying, waltzing bears faltered when she turned her attention away from them. They did not drop to the floor, but bobbled and turned and bumped against one another in a clumsy and aimless manner, quite different from their previous measured grace. He also saw indications that the previous phenomena had not all been this harmless. A ceramic lamp had been knocked to the floor and broken. One of the posters was torn. The dresser mirror was cracked. Seeing the direction of his gaze, Emmy said,
"It was scary at first, but it's calmed down, and now it's just fun. Isn't it fun?"
As she was speaking, the flute rose out of the open carrying case, up and up until it was about 7 feet off the floor, only a few feet to the left of the floating teddy bears. Out of the corner of her eye, the girl caught a glimpse of the rising instrument. When she turned to look directly at the flute, sweet music began to issue from it, not just random notes, but a well-executed tune. Emmy jumped up and down on the bed excitedly.
"That's Hanny's song! I used to play that."
"You're playing it now," Stefan said.
"Oh, no,"
she said, still staring at the flute.
"My hands got so bad, my knuckle joints, that I had to give up the flute a year ago. I'm cured now, but my hands still aren't good enough to play."
Stefan said, "But you aren't using your hands to play it, Emmy." His meaning finally penetrated. She looked down at him.
"Me?"
Deprived of her focused attention, the flute produced only a few more poorly executed notes and fell silent. It still hung in the air, but now it bobbled and dipped erratically. Emmy returned her attention to the instrument. It steadied in the air and began to play again.
"Me?"
she said wonderingly. She turned to her sister, who was still paralyzed by fear and amazement.
"Me?"
Emmy said, then looked at her parents who were standing in the doorway.
"Me?"
Stefan appreciated what the child must be feeling, and his throat was pinched so tightly with emotion that he had difficulty swallowing. A month ago, she'd been a cripple, unable to dress herself, with nothing to look forward to except further deterioration, pain, and death. Now, she was not only cured and her damaged bones re-knit, but she was also in possession of this spectacular gift. Father Vikazik wanted to tell her that somehow this gift had been given to her unwittingly by Brendan Cronin, her Pudge. But then he would have to explain where Brendan had gotten his gift, and he could not do that. Besides, he hadn't time even to tell them what he did know. It was 9:15. He should have been in Evanston by now. Time was of the essence, for Stefan was beginning to suspect that he would be catching a flight for Nevada before the day ended. Whatever was happening in Elko County was bound to be even more incredible than what was happening here, and he was determined to be a part of it. Emmy looked at the floating bears, and they resumed their formal dance once more. She giggled. Stefan thought about what Winton Toke had said only a short while ago in the Mendoza's uptown apartment. "The power's still here, still in me. I know. I feel it. And not just the power to heal. There's more." Winton had not known what powers he might possess in addition to the healing touch,
but Stefan suspected that the policeman was in for some surprises similar to those that had thrown the Hallberg household into turmoil.
"Father, will you do it yourself?"
Mr. Hallberg asked from the doorway, where he stood with his wife, his voice sharp with anxiety. Mrs. Hallberg said,
"Please, we want it to be done as soon as possible. Immediately. Can't you begin at once?"
Baffled, Stefan said, I'm sorry, but what is it you want done?" Mr. Hallberg said,
"An exorcism, of course."
Stefan stared at them incredulously, only now fully realizing why they had been in such distress when he had arrived and why they had greeted him with such relief. He laughed.
"Oh, there won't be any need for an exorcism. This isn't Satan at work. Oh, no, my heavens, no."
From the corner of his eye, Stefan saw movement on the floor. He looked down at a 2-foot-high teddy bear that was tottering past him on stiff little stuffed legs. Wenton Tolk had said that he sensed he would need a long time to learn what his powers were and to be able to control them. Either he was wrong, or the task was far easier for Emmy than for him. That might be the case. Children were much more adaptable than adults. Emmy's parents and her other sister edged into the room, fascinated but wary. Stefan understood their wariness. All seemed well, the power benign, but the situation was so awesome, so profoundly affecting on a primitive level that even an unfaltering optimist like Stefan Vikazic felt the tingle of fear. After using a payphone at a Shell service station in Elko to get in touch with Alexander Christofferson in Boston, Ginger accompanied Faye to Elroy and Nancy Jameson's ranch in the Lamoille Valley, 20 miles from Elko. The Jamesons were the Block's friends who had been visiting on the evening of July 6th, the summer before last. They had surely been caught up in the unknown events of that night and had been detained at the motel for brainwashing with everyone else, though they remembered differently, of course. According to their program of false memories, they had been allowed to evacuate the danger zone, taking Ernie and Faye with them. They believed they had returned to their small ranch, where they and the Blocks had passed the next few days. That was also what Faye and Ernie had believed, until recently. Ginger and Faye were paying a visit to the Jamesons not to inform them of what had actually happened, but to determine, as indirectly as possible, if the Jamesons were having troubles of the kind afflicting Ginger, Ernie, Dom, and some of the others. If they were suffering, they would be brought into the mutually supportive community at the motel, the members of which had come to think of themselves as the Tranquility family, and would join the search for answers. But if the brainwashing had been effective, the Jamesons would not be told anything. To tell the Jamesons would be to endanger them. Besides, given the urgent strategy developed last night with Jack Twist, if the Jamesons were not already suffering, there was no point wasting a lot of time convincing them that they'd been brainwashed. Time was precious, and every passing